transformation is the kind of buzzword, and it's not just in terms of economic and socio-political transformation. Indeed, it's about transforming the inner self as well. And psychoanalysis is well placed to meet those challenges.
Welcome to the IPA podcast. For those of you who have been listeners to the past 40 episodes of this podcast series, you know that we've been focusing on analysts who bring their clinical skills to venues outside of the consulting room, hence the name psychoanalysis on and off the couch. Given that we are all facing together a crisis of unfathomable proportions, we're going to be changing the focus of our podcast. We are going to be interviewing psychoanalysts from all corners of the globe to discuss with them how their local communities are coping with this situation, how their clinical work has been affected by this situation, and also how the internal worlds of both the analyst and the patient have been impacted by this virus, as it impacts both our real fears and our imaginary fears. We're going to encounter not only uncertainty and fear, but we're also going to learn great wisdom, gifted empathy, and hope. We'll be maintaining the title of this podcast, both as a testament to our past work and as a placeholder for our future work. I hope you find these conversations both informative and sustaining. Feel free to write comments on our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Amin Abrahams. Amin Abrahams is a training analyst at the South African Psychoanalytic Association. He has his private practice in Cape Town, South Africa. He has a special interest in the internal-external dynamics, specifically towards the redress of apartheid's legacy. He works in many areas. One of them is on setting up and providing affordable psychological services, and he's the chairman of the LOFI clinic structure as part of the Psychoanalytic Institute. He's also very heavily involved in education and training. Beyond that, what I learned and what I think will be clear to everybody is Amin's deep passion for this work, specifically living at the pivot point between the internal and the external. He speaks of the power and the importance of being aware of both at the same time. There's a great need for focus on external disadvantages, burdens, and challenges without losing focus on the importance of internal burdens, challenges that we all face in dealing with the internal. And he doesn't take the easy way out by saying he's only going to attend to one and not the other. He maintains his focus on the simultaneity of them. And though he describes great difficulties for his country and moving forward, you will also pick up, as I did, and we spoke about it towards the end, about his optimism. His optimism, I think, is hardwired for him. He just seems like a buoyant individual. But he also refers to the remarkable beauty of Cape Town, which so many have commented on, and I unfortunately have not yet visited, but do look forward to. I do hope you enjoy this conversation with Amin Abrahams. Amin, welcome to the podcast. So nice to have you with us. I think it's accurate to say that we in the States, and probably in much of the IPA world, are not aware of the state of psychoanalysis in South Africa. And hopefully our conversation today will go a long way towards remedying that. Before we get to that, though, can you fill us in on how the country is managing in this crisis? You're, to start us off, you're well, I trust, your family is well?
Thanks. Yes. Yeah. My family's well and I'm well under the circumstances.
And how is the country managing?
Well, at the moment, we at level 4 are managing the COVID-19 crisis. And what that means was that we've moved down from level 5. In level 5, we were pretty severe in terms of restrictions imposed. At the moment, level 4 is equally severe, but we allowed a little bit more flexibility of movement, even though some people might not agree with that. For example, we under curfew in level 4, and we didn't have a curfew in level 5. And what the curfew means is that at the hour of 8 o'clock in the evening to the hour of 6 o'clock in the morning, we're not allowed out at all. So that's the curfew at night. Mm. And then between 6 and 9 in the morning, we're allowed to exercise. And exercise only during those hours between 6 and 9. So what we find then on the streets is there's it's very bustling with runners and joggers and everybody's out and about, frantically try to squeeze in as much exercise to meet the 9 o'clock deadline. Level 4 also has a ban on alcohol and cigarettes, so we're not allowed to buy any alcohol or cigarettes at shops, but we are allowed to go out and shop again within specified times. So, that's what the lockdown procedure means. What it means to the treatment or the effect, rather, of the spread of the virus, apparently it has been very effective in the sense that we have under 5,000 infected cases, which for the size of the population countrywide at 60 million, apparently is very little. So certainly our government seemed to have acted very quickly to stop the spread of the virus. However, it is spreading in spite of our very obedient observance of the lockdown restrictions. The virus is spreading, particularly in what is called the township areas. Now, we still, in spite of our beloved leader Mandela's extraordinary vision to help us all get a better future, we are still left with the legacy of apartheid. Areas are still segregated between black and white, but not officially so, but more economically. And so the spread of the virus now has taken root in the so-called township areas, which is predominantly black. And what that means is that there's more rapid spread of the virus. However, again, with the qualification, the spread seems to have been identified quite early. They have hotspots targeted, the government and the health people have moved in to not only identify by testing randomly, but quarantine huge areas so that people are not only getting treatment, but to curtail and to hold and contain those hotspots so that they don't spread any further. So that's pretty much the current scenario. There's quite a bit of resentment, understandably, for people who have been denied freedom of movement, resentment for, inequalities still remain, a lot of unemployment, a lot of poverty. So it's still very skewed, the sort of difference between middle class and poor people, huge disparity. And as a result, there's quite a bit of resentment brewing as I speak. for the continuation of the lockdown procedure. People are seemingly fed up now of enduring 2 months of quite strenuous lockdown procedures, seemingly without any reward. And what they're seeing now is a spike of the virus increase rather than the flattening of the curve, as it were. So we don't know what lies ahead.
So even given the stringent rules.
That's right, yeah.
The stringent rules, you're saying, it's not succeeding, I say. One of the things that strikes me in what you've said is the prohibition against buying cigarettes. I've never heard that from anyone else or anywhere else. And I can only imagine how devastating that must be for people who are nevertheless addicted to cigarettes, to have that prohibition on top of all the others must be quite a challenge, and I imagine must lead to a black market, no?
Absolutely. I mean, addiction, as we know, as clinicians, you know, is one of the most pernicious habits, you know, to put an end to. So instead of, I don't know the wisdom behind the prohibition on cigarettes or alcohol, for that matter, but there's seemingly some link with the spread of the virus. But it's caused a huge amount of difficulties for people who are getting the habit, and it's driven the habit underground, as it were, with a packet of cigarettes selling at astronomical prices. So it doesn't stem it didn't stop the smoking habit. It's just driven it underground. From what I understand, if one has to sort of seek for some wisdom behind it, evidently, again, in the working class areas, it's not just smoking a cigarette, it's passing the cigarette around. A cigarette apparently is shared by one, two, sometimes as many as three people. And that oral passing apparently is the reason why they stopped the selling of cigarettes, because that indeed could spread the virus.
Tell us about psychoanalysis in South Africa.
Well, it's a fledgling profession in terms of its development. It's only been around 15 years. Having said that, I need to correct that immediately. It's been around 15 years in its official sort of a form with a accredited sort of training and institution and system in place. But as way back as 1920, efforts have been started by none other than a guy called Paul Sachs, who came from Russia and was trained under Theodore Reich, and indeed had some links with Freud himself. Came to South Africa in 1922. So he attempted to establish a psychoanalytic presence, but it was short-lived. Well, excuse the pun, he lived very shortly, died very young, and that put an end to his ambition and goal to establish a psychoanalytic presence. And it had to wait for another almost 100 years later for Mark and Karen Sohn to take up that mantle. And in the last 15 years, they've done pioneering work to root a psychoanalytic presence here in South Africa. So at the moment, psychoanalysis is alive and well. We have some accreditations with the IPA. We're hoping to become a component society in the not-so-distant future. At the moment, we are an independent organization, and there's about 30 analysts that have qualified, with 9 training analysts, myself included. We're still a bit thin on the ground, as it were, in terms of black people, but that is, again, for historical reasons, as well as analysis itself, as you can well imagine, is a costly affair, So we haven't had people coming in their hundreds and to join. So there's a lot of education needed to spread the gospel, as it were. But at the moment, we're having at least 10 people in training and a lot more in the wings, as it were, because psychoanalysis in South Africa consists of two separate organizations, SAPI, which is the South African Psychoanalytic Initiative, which is kind of a nursery for psychoanalysts to train proper in SAPA, which is the South African Psychoanalytic Association. So at the moment, it's a fledgling organization compared to other organizations. It's been around for decades, but it has a very, very rosy future in terms of growth.
Now, my understanding, as I've done some research on this, about what you call the nursery, the South African Psychoanalytical Initiative, which prepares people, as I understand it, in psychodynamic psychotherapy and finds those who have interest to pursue more formal training. That sounds very similar to what we have here in the psychotherapy training programs. Most institutes here in the States and elsewhere as well, we have psychotherapy programs, and a certain percentage of the students want to take it further and join full training, which is what you've described as well. I must say that when I went to your website, the South African Psychoanalytic Association, on the front page is this lovely quote from Nelson Mandela made in 2000. He said, "To be an effective agent for peace, you have to seek not only to change the community and the world, what is more difficult is to change yourself before you seek to change others." However controversial that may be, it does sound like an advertisement for psychoanalysis. And I guess that's why it's on your webpage as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
How has the psychoanalytic community dealt with this crisis? Everybody in your community and mine and everybody's had to switch rather suddenly to online work. And how have you struggled with that?
Well, it has been a struggle. Certainly, I'm predominantly involved with. Although I wouldn't like to see it like this, but I'm predominantly involved with training and helping Black psychoanalysts in training and education. And online work not everyone has access to Wi-Fi or even a laptop or a computer. Mm-hmm. But in spite of those difficulties, those who are by the means to train certainly seem to have made the adjustment. Okay, the idea of change from within, I think seeing change from without in terms of the social, these are things that become kernel, you know, in terms of transformation, which is kind of the broad canvas that we are seeing, you know, the kind of changes that's happening in our country. Transformation is the kind of buzzword, and it's not just in terms of economic and socio-political transformation. Indeed, it's about transforming the inner self as well. And psychoanalysis is well placed to meet those challenges.
Has that been a message that has been received by the community at large?
Yes, it is a message that has been received by the community at large. However, because the community, and it depends again on what sector of the community you're talking about, but the more pressed sort of community, the message might have got struck home, but bread and butter issues literally has more to do. Sure. With the home situation. So at universities, at tertiary educational institutions, there's much more receptivity to the notion of internal change. But it's slow. It's not as if the idea mm-hmm. of psychoanalysis is taken with alacrity, even by students. So there's still an enormous disparity between even amongst tertiary educated students to embrace a sort of inner journey that psychoanalysis can afford or can provide them with, rather than just looking at who's paying the fees, how they can travel to university, all the kind of normal stuff. So it's trickling down slowly, but I can't say that there's hordes of students waiting to enroll to become psychoanalysts.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's why I imagined that quote from Mandela might be seen as controversial, because it's a bit binary. He said that it's more difficult to change oneself, as if one should put aside seeking to change the community until you've changed yourself, as if one can't address both at the same time. And
yeah.
I assume he did not mean to put that aside. But in making the point about the importance of internal change, one doesn't want to neglect looking outward at the same time.
Exactly.
Can you talk to us about some clinical situations you've been involved with, disguised, of course, that will shed light on what the transition has been like in your practice?
Yes. I have a situation with, a person who didn't really take to the adjustment readily, and there's been a lot of kind of mumblings, almost resistant, like to using the sort of remote analysis method. But there was a noteworthy sort of moment in the clinical material where something that I might not have picked up in the actual consultation room, where I noticed a dog in this case, the person that has difficulty in making attachment anyway, there's huge issues around human connection almost in a kind of way that resembles spectrum disorder, Asperger's. However, the online method revealed an interesting feature, certainly for my counter-transfer, the most affectionate relation and most attached relationship with an animal that I would not have noticed in the consultation room. And indeed, this then was picked up and interpreted seemed to have made it quite a significant turnaround in the connection in the transference, from a pet to the human being, so that distance almost the animal, the pet, sort of provided a bridge in the clinical work, to have an understanding that indeed there is some a huge amount of issues still around human interaction and relationship building. However, I think the online process gave me a sort of peep into the actual life of this mm-hmm. individual, which I thought was quite significant clinically.
This was visual, or you heard the dog in the background on the phone?
No, it was visual. The camera.
Visual, yeah.
It was mimicking sort of the analytic sort of, in the sense that he couldn't see me, but I saw him, and I saw the dog coming into the room, as it were, and the most affectionate contact between the patient and the dog, so which I would not have seen had it come into the consultation.
That's been one of the changes that many have commented on, that we can see our patients' lives, their homes, and learn something about, assuming they have options, where they choose to display their camera. And likewise, depending upon where we are, they can see something about our homes. And that becomes a whole added dimension.
Exactly.
What I've wondered about is, with that added dimension, is there a loss of consideration for the meaning of the patient wanting to show us this or that piece of their lives? In other words, there's the showing, and then there's the wish to show. And sometimes you can skip the wish in the ease of the showing. So I've just had a sort of a personal curiosity about whether there's a trade-off there.
Yes, no, you're right. You know, obviously, the understanding of the presentation of material, if you like, short circuits a hell of a lot, I would imagine. Otherwise, one would have gained more in terms of just imagining and working through. The narrative, as it were, whereas here now you have a snapshot, which short circuits a lot.
A snapshot.
Yes, that is
true.
Lost. It reminds me of another sort of case conference that was presented where one of the presenters said that the camera went topsy-turvy, and for a moment the patient saw her knees and had an erotic fantasy around having seen her knees or something along those lines, and huge amount of stuff that could have come later was instantly worked through the relationship he has with his mum and all of those kind of things. But you're right. What is lost, what is gained, is a sort of instant sort of picture. And what is lost is working painstakingly through a sort of Oedipal phenomena that might have taken longer.
I mean, am I correct in perceiving an optimism in you? And I don't know if that's just in you in general or whether that's of the moment. You said earlier that psychoanalysis is alive and well and thriving in South Africa. Am I reading you right? Are you half glass full kind of thing?
On the contrary, no, I'm quite the opposite. But probably I have to talk upbeat myself because I'm quite involved in several projects within SOPA. I'm on the scientific council where we organize conferences twice a year. So there's a lot of work goes into that. And then also I'm part of the low-fee clinic structure, and a lot of work goes into that. So I'm kind of on the ground seeing the development of SOPA and SOPI, but there are a huge amount of problems at the same time. Not only does one have to deal with just getting things in order, but there are all kinds of personality, logistical, financial stuff, you know, that, can be indeed quite challenging, if not downright sort of creating obstacles in our way. So, but in spite of that, I guess I have a great vision. Let me put it differently. It's always been my passion. To have a presence in psychoanalysis, because for most of my early life, I was toying of, and indeed went abroad to get my training in England, because there was no training facilities in South Africa. So I suppose I have to be optimistic because I'm now part of something that I always wanted for most of my early adulthood, you know, from the age of 30 onwards. You know, that was a passion of mine to be actively involved in psychoanalysis.
And it sounds like you work closely with dedicated colleagues towards that end.
Absolutely. I've got committed, very, you know, dedicated, we all... Obviously, there's the tension around the vision. We all don't sing from the same hymn sheet, but there's a collective, which is to bring what you said earlier about the Mandela vision, you know, to bring about internal change. And I have to say, happily, in spite of all the difficulties that we have with the current regime around the COVID-19 crisis and managing it, they've now put mental health on the agenda, which is a big hurrah for us, because hitherto it wasn't even on the agenda, mental health, in terms of a budget and rolling out facilities in general. So, you know, and I think it's not without our effort, you know, even though we can't claim all the credit for it, but we made a contribution, certainly at the highest level, to bring about the sort of change that Mandela was talking. It's not just social, it's also individual and internal.
You know, I'm often interested and often ask those I speak with about what sustains them during this time, but you've very clearly made that clear to me and listeners that your passion for this work and your dedication to a particular vision that I think is, I don't know if it's unique to South Africa, but your focus on both the internal and the external. The external is so pressing and so pressured, and yet you keep an awareness of the internal contributions as well. And that's such a gift to be able to look at both at the same time, which, being an analyst and also being a training analyst in terms of your education of next generations, that you bring to the fore and invite others to look at with you.
Yeah.
I want to thank you for sharing that vision and for sharing that passion of yours and for sharing, the word you used was transformation. And again, the transformation you refer to is external and internal, both together. And that's the message that you apparently live by.
Exactly. And what sustains me, I think, you know, is that I'm very lucky to be able to see the fruition of those kind of almost ideals, you know, to see that I'm part of a change that is both external as well as internal, you know. So that's been a very, very healthy, sustaining moment in my life. I also obviously I'm very grateful for my wife's support that also sustains me immensely, and particularly this beautiful country of ours. You know, it's a fantastic place to be in Cape Town with all its foibles, with all the contradictions. It's a stunningly beautiful place, and that's also so sustaining just to be able to walk on the mountain, to look at the sea, and then to plunge into the depressing work, you know, that lies ahead. It's just so nice to have those kind of moments of sustenance, or, you know, that I can depend on.
Thank you so much for your honesty and your warmth and your dedication. I'm grateful to learn about it, and I'm sure our audience is as well. Thanks so much.
A pleasure, Harvey. Go well.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.